Welcome to Cult from the Embassy. It's Thursday, February 2018. I'm your host, Olamide Olanion, a staff writer at the Embassy, and joining me in the studio today is
Zach Becerra, senior staff writer at the Embassy. It's good to be here, Ola.
Yeah, the absolute boy, the East Van Morrison.
Not Jack.
It's Zach.
Follow me on Instagram. Yes. Follow me on Twitter. Nice. Don't add me on Facebook. I get scared when people do that. But yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of creepy.
Yeah, a little bit. It's a bit too much, you know.
Yeah. This show is broadcasted from CITR 101.9 FM. We're located on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Musqueam people. Called Hails from the Culture Section of the UBC, in case you didn't get that before, the University of British Columbia student paper, and we talk about what's going on in the university's culture scene. So, yeah, we talk to creators and creatives and, like, you know, the basic sitch, all the stuff that's happening around town, various projects, so... Yeah, I got Zach to come on the show. You can talk. You can basically just jut in anytime.
Okay,
but like, yeah, it's not that serious.
Okay. Yeah, but yeah, Cult is basically where it's at. We cover the news that's interesting, the culture that matters, the things that make students' life interesting. And today we're talking about a guy by the name of Francis Fukuyama.
Yeah, and we'll also probably talk about the UBC Goth story.
Oh yeah,
as well,
we can talk about goths.
We can actually talk about that first.
Can we please talk about goths? Actually, do you want to start with the goths?
The goths or UBC goths?
Both.
Okay. So we're gonna definitely do all
we're
that.
We're gonna talk about goth stuff.
Yeah, so we'll just talk about so we'll talk about Francis Fukuyama and like why is he always wrong about stuff? I don't know, we can maybe talk.
Yeah, we have time to unpack here. We can get into it for sure. Yeah.
And then we'll talk about the UBC goths on UBC. I don't know how to properly explain that, but like they're like a goth club, I guess, and like
Not exactly. We'll break it down. Do you want to start with the goths or
just give like a lowdown on what we're doing. Just like a brief like 10-second like explanation.
Cool.
Or something.
Yeah, so we're going to break down Francis Fukuyama, the goth subculture of Vancouver, and UBC Goth, UBC's hottest parody Twitter account.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Thank you very much. And then after that, like me and Zach might just like ramble incoherently a lot this show and we do in person, you know, but just stay with us. And I promise it will be fun. After that, I'll have an interview with Emma McLeod. She's a coordinator from Dive Into UBC, which is like a student-run organization. I think they're part of the calendar as well, trying to get students more involved in campus culture. So here's the show. Yeah, we'll just start off with you. So should we start off with UBC Goths?
Let's start out with UBC Goths.
Okay,
So a few months ago, a mysterious Twitter account emerged from the void.
Yes, okay, cool. Go
for
it.
I'm going to contextualize it. I'm just going to get into it. And it just started making these, it was called UBC Goth, and it started making these really hilarious gothic tweets about campus and about campus culture. Like there is something gurgling beneath the fountain. One of my favorite ones was probably this one where it was like, You turn around, Buchanan Tower appears closer than it was before. You
start
walk, you
faster.
Feel a presence on your back. You start walking faster. Just all these like fun quotes that really actually kind of to me highlighted the how scary campus can be at night and how freaky some things here are. Because UBC is so gorgeous during the day, but then when you walk around at night, especially when we had that Stranger Things like kind of fog period,
it was
genuinely a super creepy place to be. And like you know, like there's like weird lights and stuff going off everywhere, and like students coming towards you look like freaking zombies in like the fog. It is scary. It's not, and you know, UBC Goth did a really good and a very kind of in a very refined and clever way. Managed to highlight that in a really fun Twitter account. So I was so curious about this that I messaged them. I managed to get them to agree to do like a very brief interview, answer a few questions about who they were, why they decided to do it, what their inspiration was. It turns out they're very into Lemony Snicket.
Yeah. And there's a bunch of clues in there. You know, stats class, you know, like obviously a nerd, obviously.
Yeah, like we don't know much about UBC Goth. All we know about them is that they are in a stats class, they sit near the back of said stats class, and they are not Jack Cowan.
well, we know they're affiliated with the UBC because they followed mostly UBC people first.
Yes. So like that's what was really freaky is they followed all the UBC like UBC's like standard accounts, like UBC Access and Diversity, UBC Education, etc. And then they started following UBC writers. And starting with Jack Cowan, who I think our coordinating editor, who is the guy who really broke UBC Goth to the world. He retweeted it.
Yeah, he retweeted he did make the first retweet.
With the most Jack Cowan kind of like comment, which is, I'm peaked. And I'm like, of course you would say that, Jack Cowan. I hope you're listening.
I love you, Jack.
No, he's a good guy. But yeah, so that's how UBC Goth was broken to the world. We know that UBC Goth knows somebody who writes for the UBC.
Yeah, at least.
at least one person. But
or it might even be on the UBC, maybe.
No, not really. They denied that, but that's what's kind of freaky, right? Is that you took every single UBC writer. We have a big, and we have like 40, 50 staff members. I don't know. So if you were to break that up and like make a web of everyone's mutual connections, like that doesn't help. That's still like thousands of people to sift through.
Yeah.
So we don't know who UBC Goth is, and I think that's half the fun.
For y'all out there, there's actually just like a whiteboard with just like a string and like needles just pinned to it. I just have like pictures of people that work at like different parts
of
UBC.
We've been breaking this down.
Just like breaking it down. So, you know, I mean, we might give a, I will buy a cup of coffee for anyone who finds.
Man, I'll do more than that. Ola, you are lowballing.
I am a poor, my soul is poor. Sorry.
If someone can introduce me in person, because I did the interview via Twitter Messenger. Yeah. If someone can introduce me in person to the genius that is UBC Goth, like just let me shake their hand, their cold, frosty hands. I will take you out to lunch, like a nice lunch. I will wine and dine you. Okay.
Yeah. But Zach, there's more to this though, right? This is like, I mean, I'm gonna read a little bit part of like your article, right?
Go
like,
for it.
It sounds like this like account really like chilled you to the soul, right? But between the approach of finals and the arrival of a dense Stranger Things-esque fog, campus really did feel darker. The pristine walkway on Main Mall felt forsaken. The canvas around Martha Piper Fountain made it look less like a campus landmark and more like an abandoned construction site. And the hordes of deep, sleep-deprived students milling out of IKB each night were zombies in all but biology. So, like, this obviously, like, had... What was going through your mind as you were this?
Man,
like,
what was the kind of, like, effect that, like, you remember writing that? Like, that's super... Wow. I'm like, wow, this is good.
I mean, the boy.
Yeah, I don't remember writing that. I think I was really sleep-deprived, too. I think the reason for me why UBC Goth has struck such a chord on campus and why it is not just because it's funny and it's insightful, but because it kind of taps into a subculture that is coming back into vogue, which is goths, and kind of the idea that like things are kind of dark and that darkness has a certain beauty to it, but also a very morbid kind of macabre factor that makes you kind of take a second and be like, whoa. And we didn't realize this kind of stuff was all around us on UBC campus. But when final season comes around and people are already kind of in a darker, more focused mind frame, and it's, you know, it is physically darker and colder on campus, and everything just kind of feels a bit more miserable, you can definitely get into that headspace where you're like, wow, this is actually a really freaky place to be. So to me, UBC Goth really mastered social media in not only creating that account, but creating it at the perfect time to really send its message across. So all creds to you, UBC Goth, wherever you are.
So like, what kind of, so you've talked about like, you know, like the, like, how it came at the exact right time and how it's like masterful and like really just crafting this picture, right?
Mm-hmm.
But like, what would you say, what does this say about like the like student psyche, I guess, or millennial culture, youth culture, whatever? Like, what is like, what's like the reflective thing that you can kind of like, you just think about it a little bit.
I saw a tweet once. I'm just gonna totally rip off this tree.
Because your article is probably like more like an insight into like the millennial mind than like kind of like the avocado toast.
Especially the fact that you know, I am millennial, also wrote it, so it's reflected by both of us, right? But there's a tweet that I once saw, and I'm going to rip it off, which is that millennial culture is believing that if you are not successful by age 25, someone is going to come to your house and kill you.
I remember seeing that. Was that Scotchy?
I think it was, or maybe
Vicky. I don't know, I'm not sure.
But there's a certain truth to that. I think that as millennials, we were born into an age where we're trying to figure out things because the things that were figured out don't apply anymore on so many levels, economically, philosophically, etc. So we're inclined to look at the world, I think, with a bit of a darker, more kind of pessimistic worldview, but also trying to find some beauty in it. And that's really what, you know, goth literature was about. It was about taking things that are like really sad, romantic, powerful, poignant, and sort of twisting them into things that are very beautiful and very memorable and very important for life. Like that kind of sad romance kind of spiraling out, you know?
Like, it's like everything sucks, but like, you know, sometimes you get it, you know? Sometimes like life just looks really beautiful.
Kind of. Or at least there's some beauty in the suffering, or there's some suffering in the beauty, either way you want to take it. So to me, that goths and millennial culture, there's actually a lot of crossover there. I can totally see that.
Are we saying that gothic and goths are like in the same vein? Is that what we're saying? Or is me trying to segue into like the next conversation with like goth scene?
I mean goths definitely draw a lot of kind of their ethos from the original gothic literature, right? Like, again, that idea that there's
gothic is who like go through the literature. Who's So,
to me, the classic gothic writer is like Edgar Allan. Okay. Like the Brontes, yeah. But then also Edgar Allan Poe. Okay. Edgar Allan Poe, to me, is like the like dark romantic like 1800s gothic writer as far as like just pure sadness in his works and pure kind of like overly like dramatic sorrow. That's Edgar Allan Poe, that's the Brontes. And so the idea of that is drawing a lot of beauty out of these really sad, like terrible moments, you know, like yeah. all that suffering. Goths are a lot more fun. I would say they emerged kind of in the late, you're looking at like the mid-late 70s to the 80s were the first goths. Those are those people who like tend to wear like some of the styles associated with goths are lots of leather, studs, really crazy frizzy black hair, really pale face makeup, yeah. black lipstick, black eyeliner, etc. People like The Cure is the goth band, I would say.
Yeah.
Disintegration is the greatest album of all time, and I will fight anyone who questions that. You know, yeah. And so like, there's definitely some crossover between those two groups. They're both appreciating the sorrow in life, but you know, they are different. But that segues us into the next goths,
story. So did you pitch that story?
I pitched out the story to Henry Anderson, who's a great writer. So there's a club in Vancouver called The Red Room, which I'm sure many people here are familiar with.
It's nice. I mean, they have a Latin night on Fridays, right?
Yeah, everyone knows about the Latin night. What people don't know about is the goth night. Yeah.
Nice.
So on some of the Sundays, you can go to Descent, which is Vancouver's oldest, longest-running goth party event.
How long has it been running?
Like, I think decades at this point.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, a long time. Like, it's like 20 years, something like that. So this thing's been going for a while. And we sent a very not goth writer to this event. Like,
Describe.
Henry is he's the kind of kid that you would totally bring home to your mom. And I mean that in the best way. Like, Henry, you know, like,
the most wholesome way.
Nice, tall, wholesome, like, friendly, you know, stands up straight, very peppy.
Has
you
good
know.
Posture.
Good posture, you know, like he's an English and philosophy major, you know, like very short cut, like crisply cut blonde hair. He just want to pinch his cheeks and send him off. No, not to demean the guy. He's, you know, but yeah, he's not, you know, a goth kind of person. He doesn't look like punk or subversive in sort of his style. He's not super into that culture at all. He didn't really know much about goth culture before he went to this event, which is part of the reason why I thought it'd be interesting to send someone who was an outsider. And because of that, when he went to Descent, he actually, I think, had a more meaningful experience from it. And he was able to glean more about
very
the subculture.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I think one thing that he really touched upon really well in going to Descent and checking it out was that goths are kind of rare and that they're people who are wholly comfortable in being themselves. And in this day and age, that's something to really commend. Yeah.
Could you see that, like, obviously, like, this is me making, like, a bigger statement about, I guess, like, millennial culture again, right? And, like, if you look at the fact that millennials are starting to have this weird—I hate the word millennials just because like the fact that.
But you say it so much.
I know, but millennials aren't even really like.
But
a
I'm
thing,
like every
know?
Time Ola says millennial, take a shot.
It's like millennial culture. But you know what I'm saying, right? It's like it's very much like millennials are right now, at least the youth, are trying to like really push back against that. Like, you know, we have to care about everything because like. It's been always just told to us that we don't care. We don't care much about anything. Does that make sense? Like, we've been told ever since, like, before we were born, right? That, like, millennials are entitled and, like, they only care about themselves and whatever, right?
Yeah.
And, like, we've been trying to, like, you know, fit into this box for, like, a really long time, right? And, like, now people are, like, actually trying to, like, break out of that mold.
I mean, honestly, is that different from any generation to another?
That's why I think millennial is, a category is meaningless, right?
I think it's just really, really funny to me because I think that millennials rejected a lot of the things that previous generations had enjoyed, Generation X, and especially the baby boomers, as far as our sensibilities and stuff. And we chose other things that we care deeply about. And so we get ridiculed for the things that we care deeply about, things like social media and personal image and perhaps even awareness around things like mental health. And we get totally, like, torn apart for the things that we don't care as much about. Like, for example,
like toilet paper.
Yeah.
Toilet paper? We were killing those napkin industry
napkin industry are buying wedding rings or, like, traditional marriages and things like that. Like,
and, like, we're not buying houses. Wow. Yeah, I wonder why.
Yeah, exactly. And, like, it's like a lot of these things aren't our fault. We're just not in an economic situation where people in our generation can afford to do that. But it's also maybe that we looked at some of these things and we decided, hey, those are not for us. Yeah. And that's totally fair. And I think that the beauty of goths is that this is a group that was a sub, like very much a subculture in the 80s and 70s. You know, it wasn't typical to like have like a huge goth crew at your school. And now that we're in a stage where we're rediscovering all these older cultures that occurred in the 20th century and bringing them back, I think a lot of aspects of goth fashion and music and whatever have actually kind of
like
found their way.
Like Lucy Vert and like, you know, right?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, yeah, I feel like there's a lot of like, it have like made into rap music and like the like the subversive parts of like goth and like you know
there's like goth rap now and stuff, and you see a lot more people rocking kind of paler makeup and like dark lipstick, and that dark like that look is coming back into fashion. There's bands I would say that are part of like the modern emo revival that also have like goth elements. We can talk about American Baseball, but I'd rather not do that. There you have it. Like, I think that goths are really coming back in, so maybe that's why we've been doing so much bloody goth coverage at the UBC recently.
I love that you brought it right back. You know, like I was just like rambling, trying to like find where I was trying to make the point I was trying to make, but you really got in there.
You know, that's
like,
what I do. I center it down.
What was like the most interesting as you're editing this piece? Did you edit this piece?
I did. Okay,
yeah. So like, what was like the thing that like you pulled out of it that was like really really interesting, or like the most interesting or funny scene, or like the thing that blew your mind?
Man, like to me, it was just. My favorite part is kind of the beginning where Henry talks about there's this one woman who's just kind of doing this weird swaying dance on the dance floor by herself, and then going and seeing her friends and having some wine, and then going back and keeps doing it. To me, that's awesome because, man, dancing by yourself is something that's like coming out of fashion. Yeah. Again, like we can talk about millennial culture as being so self-conscious. It's being afraid that if you're dancing by yourself or doing something dumb, that someone's going to videotape it or photograph it. And then, you know, it'll be stuck around forever. And you're worried about ridicule maybe on that level because of that. Here's someone just like having fun and doing their thing in a place where that's what you're supposed to do. And I think there's something very beautiful and special about that. I think it's a shame when you're so afraid of being documented that you don't want to just let loose and have fun and dance or do something dumb, you know, as long as you're not obviously not hurting anybody, but do something dumb and fun, you know, just go for it.
Cool. Yeah, we'll take a break a little bit. We'll play some PSAs and ads. We'll be right back.
I love advertisements.
Up next, we'll talk about Fukuyama probably for a short while because I want to go into the interview. But
yeah.
Thanks so much, Zach.
All right. Thank you, Ola.
Thank you. All right.
At Dunkin' Donuts, each and every
radio show
is brewed fresh and served fresh at the peak of its flavor. If you're a tough customer, only the taste of this
radio show
will do. So go ahead, let Dunkin' Donuts make your
radio experience
exquisite.
Indeed.
Dunkin' Donuts, serving sweet treats from the Pop Underground. Thursdays, noon to 1.
Midweek news broke that Teo Dezar wasn't going to be playing in this game.
He's growing sport, and to do it on a university campus with an educational message behind it.
They'll be facing off against all the big teams from all the other conferences and the nationals.
Want to be a CITR sports broadcaster? Looking for a cool way to get involved in UBC sports? Then email sports101@citr.ca or come by our station in the Nest to find out more. See you soon.
Beside, proximity to the arts is cleansing for the soul.
If there's any lesson we can take from High School Musical, it's that the arts are a vital part of any community. Join the CITR Arts Collective to see movies, theater, dance, or live comedy shows and share your thoughts on air. The Arts Report airs every Wednesday at 5 p.m. Email volunteer@citr.ca to get involved.
And we're back. You're listening to Cult on CITR 101.9 FM. We're a culture show from the campus newspaper called the UBC. Mm-hmm. I don't want to say we're the best, but we're one of the best. We are easily one of the best.
Man, we're the best. You got us stunted.
We're not even like one of the best college newspapers. We're one of the best newspapers, period.
Oh, okay.
Hot take.
Now we're getting dangerous. Man, I'm really worried. I've got people from like the Globe and Mail trying to kill me now.
Yeah, we're not going to ever get an internship at the Globe and Mail anymore.
Yeah, it's not happening. After that, we're too big for our britches, man. Too big for our britches.
So we're broadcasting from the unceded Musqueam Territories on the CITR 101.9 FM. I'm your host, Alam Dialanian, with me here.
Zach Becerra, senior staff writer for the UBC.
Nice. And yeah, Zach went to the Francis Fukuyama talk that's held mm-hmm. by the Lind Initiative. Just first of all, Fukuyama.
Francis
who is
Fukuyama,
who
the man,
who
the myth.
Like,
the
I know, and a lot of us are like the same because we did like poli sci,
yeah,
IR stuff.
But
right? Like,
I agree that people outside those disciplines don't realize how big of a deal Francis Fukuyama is.
Like, he was the first person I read in poli sci class.
He's a huge deal in political science because his political philosophy comes kind of after the, really starts to come after the end of the Cold War. Yeah. So it starts to define that Cold War period. And what he's most well known for is what he calls the end of history. So after the Berlin Wall falls, after the Soviet Union disintegrates and, you know, these countries are now open to international trade, Fukuyama predicts basically a classical liberal dream where every country is going to become a liberal democracy. We're going to have something along the lines of democratic peace theory, meaning that, you know, Fukuyama believes these democracies won't fight each other because democracies are adverse to war. And we're going to have global international trade uniting all of them. So we're just going to have an end of history because there will be no deviation from this norm of democracy.
Yeah.
And at the present... Yeah, it's looking...
He over-relies on, like, norms, to be unforeseen power.
To be fair, at the time Fukuyama wrote that, that seemed really likely because you were looking at more and more democracies being created. There was a new third wave of democracies being created, right? Like, the first wave is, like, countries like America and France and Britain. Then you have decolonization. Then you have the end of the Cold War. So all these countries are now becoming democracies, and Fukuyama's plan looks really good. We have the emergence of kind of these third wave politics that are, like, really heavy on international trade and things like the WTO.
Globalization,
et cetera, et cetera, the internet, all that good stuff. But recently, Fukuyama got invited for this talk at the Lind Initiative because the theme of these talks and of this sort of initiative is the unraveling of the global liberal order. And I think we really have to use the word unraveling here because the question that's being posed is the liberal order, whether it be in the United States or in Turkey or in Poland, is coming apart. It's unraveling, but it's still there for now.
It's in the process of unraveling.
There is still a canvas, and it's sometimes it unravels a little bit, and then we put part of it back together. But the question that I think is kind of posed by the word unraveling is, do we want to put this thing back together, or do we want to make something new? Or do you want to completely unravel it so that we can make something out of the thread? Yeah. What do we do with this liberal order that is collapsing in some senses, but in some senses also holding very strong? And that's what Fukuyama was essentially here talking about, as well as promoting his new book. But
what's the new book?
The new book is about, well, he's got two books. The book that he most recently released was about sort of his new vision of geopolitics in the world, especially in regards to Asia and China. Fukuyama during the talk particularly mentioned that he sees China as actually in some ways being a more problematic foe than Russia, than Vladimir Putin, just because, you know, people don't realize it, but China is, like, by population the biggest country in the world. It's got really strong economic growth at 6.6% of GDP, I believe, in 2017. It's got huge military capacity. It's in a very strategic zone as far as, like, you know, like being the hub of Asia. And its GDP is slowly catching up to that of the United States. And we actually have to look at maybe China as being, you know, it is a superpower. We have to look at it as being a potentially very powerful actor in that area.
It could potentially be the center of a new, like,
Right? So that's what his most recent book is about. His upcoming book is all about identity politics in the United States. Fukuyama's diagnosis for why things went wrong as far as liberal democracies go has a few elements to it. The start is the 2008 recession. He believes that basically destabilizes this gravy train that everyone's been riding. But, you know, a lot of people would, like, I take umbrage with that a little bit.
Yeah, like, most of the African countries that descend to war happened long before that. That's the thing,
is that Francis Fukuyama, God bless him, he tries to kind of save his thesis by saying that between 1970 and, like, you know, 2008, everything went well because the great powers did not go to war. But that's not accurate. They didn't go to war in Europe, that's very true, but they went to war, like, Vietnam, we could talk about Korea, we can talk about civil war in Angola, we can talk about conflicts across the globe that had a Cold War element to them, that were proxy wars, that were driven by Cold War elements. They just happen to happen in other places. And Fukuyama kind of ignores that. In fact, in his talk, one thing that I noticed was that the only country outside of what we would traditionally call the West, and also China and Russia, that he mentioned he talked very briefly about Turkey, actually, you're right. But the only time he mentioned Latin America was Venezuela. And he talked about it very briefly as an example of a collapsing populist state and then went back to it. He didn't talk that extensively about Africa at all, or like African countries, what's their role to play. He only spoke about China. He didn't mention, for example, Indian geopolitics, which are very interesting, or any of those other countries. He was very Eurocentric and America-centric.
But to be fair, we can't expect him to talk about every single country, right?
No,
but
like, it's fair.
But it does feel like there's like glaring, like, you know... tunnel vision, where he's just like trying to like save the thesis, right?
And
like,
honestly, he's a professor at Stanford. It makes sense that he's focusing on American politics, right? That's totally fair. But his thesis, kind of only, you know, that everything was great between 1970 and 2008, is really focused on those regions.
Yeah.
To him, after 2008, there's a problem because workers in industrialized countries are now not getting that gravy train of international growth that is going.
I like the word gravy train.
Yeah, they're not getting in on the gravy or as much of it as they like, because, you know, they're not getting the healthcare benefits that they enjoyed in eras like the 1960s. Their wages aren't going up. A lot of their jobs are being lost because of automation, and also because other markets are emerging that can do that work for cheaper outsourcing. So these people are the reason that we have the destabilization of the liberal order in the United States. And that's why people vote. You know, these are the people who went and voted for Donald Trump. And Fukuyama also says that part of the problem, or what he believes is the problem, is that the left, in embracing identity politics, abandoned sort of the great coalition of working forces that had made it really powerful in the 1960s. And to me, again, that's an area where I think Fukuyama was a little bit unfair.
Yeah.
Because I agree that the left in the United States, the Democratic Party, isn't necessarily the workers' party anymore. I don't think there's any question about that. I think that, you know, we shouldn't undersell identity politics and the importance that this has brought about, and also the value this has brought about in American society. Yeah. I mean, the 1960s was also an era of so many civil rights movements, whether it be for African Americans, whether it be for gay people, whether it be for women, that had a huge transformative effect and really improved the conditions of millions of people in the United States. So again, Fukuyama, you know, he's got his agenda. He's very much a classical liberal, which is a conservative. Yeah. And he's focused on kind of these things. But yeah, he basically has this interesting worldview and this interesting long-term outlook on how things happen. And his insights on populism, I think, are actually very powerful as well.
Yeah, it's like the left having progressive politics, or having like, you know, anti-oppressive politics, right? Mm-hmm. Like if you're having that and you're having like a broad coalition, you kind of need to think about like, you know, identity politics and how that affects other parts
exactly.
of oppression, right? So I don't know.
Yeah.
Makes sense. Was there anything exciting? Did anybody like throw a shoe at a?
There was one girl who I'm pretty sure is in my history class. Shout out to everyone in 432. Who asked him when he made the comment about identity politics? She just stood up and she just said, hey, like, what about this? And then he immediately kind of backed off, which was actually cool. Like, I don't think people appreciated that we just saw one of the most recognized and revered scholars of international relations get shut down by a 20-year-old. That was kind of awesome for me, and I really enjoyed seeing that. Aside from that, there were some very, like, kind of weird and kind of interesting questions thrown around about, like, artificial intelligence that I thought were kind of interesting. And I think that what was just most scary about the talk for me is that Francis Fukuyama, someone that we know as a maker of great predictions, of great insights into the future, really had no clue what was going to happen.
That's terrifying.
Yeah, his only kind of, you know, he's like, oh, it'll settle down, it'll like decrease.
It'll go back to the order.
Yeah, he actually kind of tried to state that. He said, oh, the American voters won't fall for Donald Trump again, and we don't have to worry about this. But when he was asked by the host, whether we could see another kind of celebrity presidential candidate come up, you know, whether it be Oprah or Kanye West or just someone equally crazy, right? Like just coming up and doing their thing. And his response was, well, long response, but he basically said, yeah, it's still possible. And the commentator was like, well, that's terrifying and awful. So Fukuyama to me this time brought a lot of warnings, a lot of very scary warnings about populism. And that should be disconcerting for all of us, honestly.
Well, thank you so much, Zach, for coming over.
Thank you, Ola.
I appreciate it. You are the best boy ever. I appreciate that.
I feel like that's something you tell a dog, man. I'm a little offended.
My dog. Yes.
Man, I want a treat after this. I want some snacks.
I'll get you a coffee sometime.
Oh, cool.
Sure. All right. See you soon.
All right.
Bye, so, we'll just have some PSAs and we'll be right back.
Discorder, that free magazine from CITR, has been documenting the best in music, arts, and culture since 1983. Let's see what one man of prestige has to say about Discorder.
What up, though? This is Big Snoop Dogg. and I fucks with Discorder magazine. How about that?
Smoke weed every day.
Pick up a copy around Vancouver or fuck with Discorder online at discorder.ca.
Well-known pimp, narcotics king, big-time racketeer, back in full force.
This could be one of the big moments in your life. Don't make it your last.
Look, this thing might be bigger than even we think it is.
Do you need an upgrade to the soundtrack to your life? Perhaps a song from a film or a tune from TV? My name is Gap. Exploding Head Movies is here to give you sounds from the cinema, along with the songs that will be defining your future, and those forgotten classics that need a little rescue.
Yeah. Come on, baby. Come on. I won't let you down. Follow me.
Exploding Head Movies, Monday, 7 to 9 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Do you have any awareness of what's been happening with newspapers in the last 10 years?
Not at all. I mean, truth is, I don't even get them anymore. I just read the news on my phone. It's so much better, and it's free.
Yeah, that makes sense.
The future of news media is in your hands. If you're interested in independent journalism and current affairs, CITR's News Collective is for you. Help hound down stories about diverse and underrepresented issues in the Lower Mainland for Democracy Watch, airing every Thursday at 5 p.m. Email volunteer at citr.ca to get involved.
Breakaway over the blue line, cuts to the net. What a play!
Ryan, Fashanu.
Oh, what a goal! Oh, that's a magnificent goal!
And he takes a shot at it. There it goes. It is out of here.
Throws to the back of the end zone, and it is caught for a touchdown.
Do those moments thrill and exhilarate you? Do you want to be a part of the excitement? Join the CITR Sports Collective. The show airs every Thursday at 3:30 p.m. and live broadcasts volleyball and basketball games at the War Memorial Gym. We need collective members like you to host color commentary and talk all things UBC sports. Everyone is welcome and there's no experience necessary. Email volunteer at citr.ca to get involved.
Hello, Vancouver. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. You're listening to Cult, the show from the UBC's campus newspaper, the UBC. So we're just going to plug into our conversation with Emma McLeod from Dive into UBC. We'll talk about Dive and what role they play in fostering campus culture. Hope you enjoy. You've seen them promote events on social media, and you've probably seen a lot of their artist spotlights, and you've also probably been to a lot of their events as well. We're talking to Dive into UBC, the student-run organization trying to get students more interested in campus culture. I'm here with Emma McLeod, Dive into UBC coordinator. Welcome to the show.
Thanks.
Cool. So let's talk about your organization. When you're marketing your organization to students, how do you usually pitch it?
Yeah, so essentially, I guess the pitch that I would give would be that Dive into UBC is a collaborative arts and culture organization, and you've kind of already said it, but we exist basically to bring arts and culture to the forefront of the student experience and really try to promote all the different types of arts and culture that are going on campus.
So why was it created? Like, was there like a certain need or like certain problem that Dive sought to like solve?
Yeah, so I think 4 or 5 years ago, this group of students noticed a gap between all of the arts and culture events that were happening and students just not knowing that they were going on or not feeling like that was their scene. So Dive into UBC was created to bridge that gap and to bring out students to all of the different things that were going on.
Cool. Has that problem been solved?
I wouldn't say that it's been solved.
How is the progress on that, though?
Well, I definitely think that there's been improvement. I mean, for example, we just had an event at the Museum of Anthropology.
The Arts and Culture Night?
Yeah, the Arts and Culture Night. And the attendance for that event, you just see it steadily grow.
Yeah.
And some of the artists that we got to work with, for example, UBC Slam, they were saying, like, this is way bigger crowd than I'm used to performing for. So I think that for sure indicates that students are being exposed to new things, which is...
Are there, like, raw numbers increases? Are clubs, like, getting more hype around them, I guess, because of, like, your events, or is that...
I would say yes. Okay. But, again, it's one of those things where it definitely changes year to year. It changes depending on the club. But I think that's why it's important to keep adapting and keep, like, doing new things every year.
Cool. Yeah, thank you. So the Arts and Culture Night, right? That's one of your types of events, right? Could you kind of, like, mention any of the other events you kind of put together?
Yeah, for sure. I think another one that's been quite successful that we started last year, it's called Laugh More, and it's our stand-up comedy show.
That's on the Kerners, right?
It's happened, actually, in a bunch of different venues. Okay. It's been at Kerners, and upstairs at Kerners as well. And then we're actually doing another one next month in Buchanan D in the Mass space.
Cool. And when you say, like, arts and culture, what do you mean? So, like, are you, like, what kind of events are you, like, really gearing for? What is like, the hard line boundaries of, like, where arts and culture? Is it just, like, poetry, comedy? Like, what are we talking about?
So that's actually kind of a conversation that we have every single week when we're deciding what events to promote for that week, because it can be really hard to draw that line. And something that we've been actually talking about, I mean, obviously, you know, music events, comedy, slam, improv, that obviously fits into what we want to promote. But then we look at things like the new Indigenous Center opening up, and they're having... I think just like an opening ceremony, and like, is that something that we would want to promote? I think yes. So it's sometimes not so clear cut where that line is, but I think anything, it's a pretty broad category. Yeah. Anything that sort of vaguely fits in there, we're excited to promote and excited to get on students' radar.
Yeah. So before, like, we started the interview, right? You mentioned that, like, you weren't here for the Drake Hotline Bling video viral campaign, right?
No, yeah. I wasn't, but I was definitely exposed to it, and I did know people that worked on it.
Okay, cool. So do you just talk a little bit about yourself, I guess, Emma McLeod? Just, like, let us know who you are.
Yeah, well, I'm a third-year student. I'm in Honors History and IR, and I came to UBC as a transfer student and kind of had no idea what was going on campus at all and was really interested to find out. So the first thing that I actually found out about was the calendar, and that was kind of my gateway into Dive. I joined Dive immediately after because I was specifically interested in arts and culture, and then once you get into sort of that network, you just realize that there's so much going on and a little bit of discrepancy between people actually, like, getting out to see these like amazing events. So I became really interested in just trying to promote that.
Cool. When was, like, the moment you realized, like, you really, really liked Dive and you wanted to, like, stay and, like, just keep doing that work?
Honestly, it was pretty immediately after I joined. I mean...
Was there, like, a certain, like, moment, like a eureka epiphany moment? The clouds clearing and, you know, like, sun shining or something. You were like, yes, this is it.
I'm trying to think if there's something specific. Actually, yeah, okay, I got it. So the first event that I worked, that I was sort of, like, really involved with was we did Thrive at the Hatch, which was essentially just a showcase event, but it was all the proceeds went to the BC Mental Health Foundation, and it took place up in the Hatch Gallery upstairs in the Nest.
What was that?
That was proceeds went to the BC Mental Health Foundation, and it took place up in the Hatch Gallery upstairs in the Nest.
What was that?
That was in the fall of last year, and it was just this fantastic event. We had a bunch of different musicians. We had a stand-up comedian. The Origami Club was there, like, leading workshops. We had someone doing live painting, and it was just this incredible sort of, like, mix of arts that were going on all at the same time.
And it was for a good cause, I guess.
Yeah, and it was also
Thrive Week.
Thrive Week. So it was really exciting getting to see all of those different artists showcase, and also we got to collaborate with BVP, the Blank Vinyl Project, and I think also AMS Events helped with the space. So
this was just all for, like, Thrive Week, which was for the mental health awareness, kind of, or, like, stress, reducing stress and stuff, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Cool. So, yeah, you mentioned a little bit earlier about how the origins of the club, the founders, like, realized there was a discrepancy between, like, you know, people that were interested, but, like, there weren't many people going to campus culture events, right? Could you, like, just speak more about that a little bit? Like, who are the founders and When did it start? Yeah.
It started, I want to say 4 or 5 years ago, and I feel a little bit bad because I know there were 3 founders, but I only know one of their names.
That's fine.
And that was Sam Masule.
Okay.
But there were 2 other people working very closely with him. I haven't had the opportunity to meet them.
That's fine.
But so when I joined Dive, it was just after it had joined with the calendar, and the 2 people that sort of made it what it is today are Jared Bedilianaga and then Aaron Giesbrecht. They took Dive from just this idea to like a concrete thing that it's still, we now have all of these structures in place that we actually want to carry forward. Whereas before it was like every single time there was something new, we had to essentially start from scratch and figure out like, okay, how are we going to build this?
Yeah.
And now we have like some momentum, some foundations to build off of.
That's very cool. So there's a lot of arts and culture groups at UBC. You've worked with the UBC calendar. You're basically part of the UBC calendar right now, right? So do you want to kind of like talk a little bit about like what, like I guess, differs you from the calendar itself, even though like you're part of the calendar, right? But what's like the thing that sets you apart from most of the other groups like BVP and all these other groups apart? Yeah,
for sure. The main thing that sets us apart from the calendar is that we are the arts and culture branch of the calendar. So the events that we're promoting, the work that we're doing is actually just a completely different portfolio of events.
The calendar is like mostly parties, right?
Yeah, the calendar does parties and also sort of just events that are more for the broader community, like campus animations, you know, polar bear swim, snowball fight. They also were able to participate with the reconciliation poll ceremony last year, but Dive is specifically for arts and culture, which again, broad label, but it definitely sets us apart from just like the parties.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
What's like the, I guess, the hardest thing that the time that you've been with the group, what's the hardest thing you've had to like, you know, overcome as a group?
I think we have been in some situations where I think we've always kind of been encouraged to bite off more than we can chew, but there have been some moments where we just couldn't quite do it with the numbers that we have. We're not a very big organization in contrast to the calendar, which is, you know, 60 plus members.
How many
members
are in the Dive group?
Dive is less than 10, and it's 5 execs.
When you have
this sort of experience like working with the calendar and you have all of that mobility like and the team behind you, you think you can do things and then you realize like, oh no, we are only 10 people. We can't quite, we don't have the same power.
So
but
do those events just like fizzle out, or like you don't just don't do them?
Well, no. So the thing is, we've never said no. Like we've never gone back once we've committed to doing an event. It's just it can be very difficult day of just like
burnout.
Literally like running around the city. Like for example, just trying to get to Long and McQuaid to rent lights and things when you're only a team of 5. It's like you lose a significant portion of your team to stuff like that. But we make it work. Yeah. So
I mean, so you all really just care about what you're doing, right?
I like, think that's the big thing is we truly do like really care and really believe in the work that we're doing. And we've seen it have really good results. So even when the work gets hard, we're still motivated to do it.
Yeah. What are the highlights of the job? Like when you're always like, I really enjoy this job right now.
Honestly, I always feel this glow after every successful event. I actually was able to MC the event last week at the Museum of Anthropology.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and just looking out. Thank you. I was nervous, but I did it. but just looking out on the crowd and seeing people excited about you know, things like Slam, where they don't get a huge audience. I've kind of already said that, but like, it's really cool to see people enjoying a new art form and like you always think like maybe they'll go home and they'll look into it or they'll be interested in coming out to the next one. And of course just seeing like the hard numbers of ticket sales and stuff
it
feels good. I believe we sold just under 300, so it was quite big.
Cool. So I think I noticed that, like, some of the things on the Instagram kind of have changed, right? So, like,
yes.
I remember they used to be, like, really cutesy images, you know, like, symbols. I don't know what happened. I really enjoyed those, but do you want to kind of, like, explain?
Yeah. I've gotten that feedback from a few people. Oh. We were just kind of...
I actually just brought you here to just, like, interrogate
about the Instagram.
God damn it, guys. Come on.
Yeah. We were experimenting with a new look, and that's kind of the feedback that we've been getting. I think we're actually... One of our hopes is that we'll be able to collaborate with an illustrator who will be able to actually, like, put those images together for us. But it'd be nice to actually be producing our own images. So I think having received that feedback, like, we hear it, and we'll definitely.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm gonna, like, call up again and see what's up. Yeah. Cool. So any other things you want to kind of say before? I guess what's, like, the plan for the future? That's, like, the first part of that question.
Yeah. I think. Just while I have this platform, the thing that makes Dive really, really successful and really exciting is the collaborative aspect of it. So we are always, always open to new ideas from, it doesn't matter if you're with a club or if you're just an individual, if you have an idea and you're not sure how to put it into motion, like, shoot us a message on Facebook, slide into our DMs. Like,
very good. Cool. Well, thank you very much, Emma.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You're just playing a game. It's more than that. It's about adventure and saving.
That's the show for the week. Thanks to Zach Vissera and Emma McLeod for coming onto the show.
BBC Theater and Film.
The music for this episode was Knock Knock by Poddington Bear from the Free Music Archive. If you missed part of the show or just want to check out other episodes, you can find us on citr.ca. Don't miss us too much. I'm Alam Dialanion. Thanks for listening.